Fred Film Radio, Turin Film Festival, Italy.
Fred Film Radio from the Torino Film Festival. I'm Angela Cerbi, and I'm here with Fedra Fateh, the deputy director of the festival. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, good afternoon, actually, more or less, because we are in the afternoon. We are starting one of our of a series of meetings with between us, talking about the festival, the contents, what you did, any issues that come to mind, in order to give to our audience a wider feeling, a wider picture of what the Torino Film Festival is. So you are here for the first time, and you are, just tell us briefly, how did you come in touch with the Torino Film Festival? How did you come up to get in this position?
Well, actually, I had the pleasure of being in Torino in 2002 for the festival. I was accompanying Amir Nadiri, who is one of Iran's greatest filmmakers, whose programs were often screened on Fore o Radio of Rai Television. So as Italy is a country that loves cinema and loves independent cinema, there's always been an appreciation for Iranian cinema. So I was here in 2002 with Amir when I had the opportunity to meet Stefano and many of the wonderful independent film community here in Torino. I stayed in touch with him. Our paths crossed again in Venice. I want to say it was around maybe 2009 when Amir Nadiri did another film in Japan called Cut that had an all-Japanese cast. It was all done in Japanese. I happened to be living at that time between Morocco and Japan, so I had been on the set with Amir in Japan and watched him do that really fascinating film, which is interesting because there's a, it's really about the love of film. That film is about the love of film. And so when the film was invited to Venice, of course, you know, Amir is like a family member to me. So I showed up in Venice and I was on the red carpet with short hair and my, you know, red carpet dress. And I did see Stefano again. We were there celebrating cinema, celebrating Amir. So we've stayed in touch. Stefano is a very special person. He's he's a film scholar and intellectual. He's a deeply thoughtful person. He's very much someone who appreciates culture and people. So all of us, you know, when you get to this age, we all have lots of friends, but there's some people that we stay in touch with. So Stefano was one of those special friends. Even though we actually haven't spent a lot of time together, each time it was very meaningful. So then last year, I had been working in Japan. You know, I'm an attorney. I work in finance, and I work with, you know, asset managers. So I have a kind of, you know, law and finance type of job. And I was back in New York after my, my assignment in Japan ended. And I responded to the kind of evolving crisis of the Me Too movement in the United States, but that has also rippled, you know, everywhere. And I wrote a book, and I used a pen name because I wanted to be free to say what I wanted to say, and I didn't want it to interfere with my, you know, more conservative image as an attorney where I represent, you know, companies and clients. And so this is, again, that the kind of the interesting aspect of being an artist and being creative is that you put on another persona. So I chose to put on another persona, my book, which, by the way, only... I decided this year to sort of out myself and identify myself with the book. So the book is called The Mating Manifesto. I use the pen name Mickey Gladwell, which I can explain later. And I sent the book to Stefano last year, around October, November. And he said to me that he really liked the book. I reference cinema in the book. We can talk about the book later. And he said to me that he's being considered to be the deputy, to be the director of the Torino Film Festival. And he asked me whether I would be willing to be part of his team should he be chosen. I said, of course. So very early in January, he shares the good news that he's gotten the position. And initially, he asks me to help be the sort of international liaison because he wanted to make the festival more international. And as I was based in New York and I've worked in China and Japan and Hong Kong and Morocco and I have, you know, contacts everywhere.
You were the perfect woman in the perfect moment.
Yes. And I have to say again, to Stefano's credit, in the early days, you know, the concept was that I would just assist. So it meant reaching out to a celebrity or a filmmaker. And as he gave me the initial list of people that he wanted to invite, I have to say, it was very white and very male. And because Stefano is so open-minded and such a, true creative intellectual, I said to him, Stefano, you know, in America, there's this growing crisis and outcry regarding gender inequality, and especially in cinema. So as we know, the Oscars, there was a statement about how the nominees were very white and very male. And to Stefano's credit, he immediately said to me, well, why don't you join me as the deputy director of the festival? So instead of, punishing me for not taking his direction, again, a credit to his intellectual flexibility and his open heart and open mind, he said, you're perfect for the team. So again, with the support of the leadership of the Museum of Cinema and Enzo Gigo, again, to his credit, to welcome a foreign woman, an Iranian from New York City to their team is really a testament to the flexibility, the innovation, the openness, which is what the Torino Film Festival has stood for all these years.
So, and then you're here doing your job. Your job was selecting the jury and planning, besides other small things, I think, but the main ones were selecting the jury and building up some of the masterclasses that are going to happen. The jury is all women, and the Torino Film Festival is following the protocol stated by the Toronto Film Festival about the 50-50 2020, which means that in the in the competition section, in the competitive sections, the films have to be 50% from men directors and 50% from women directors. The choice of having a whole female, all women jury was yours, and how did you get to this decision?
Again, I have to give credit where credit is due, as we say in America. As we discuss the issue of gender equality and fair representation, we came to the decision together. So Stefano and I together came to the decision that by having an all-female jury, we were making a statement. On the one hand, when all the decision makers are men, it doesn't even, become a topic of conversation. We take it for granted when we see men, leading over 170 of the 195 countries in the world. When you turn the television on and you look at ministers and heads of state and foreign ministers and defense ministers and corporate CEOs, no one asks the question, how come they're all male? So sometimes you need to be provocative, and the idea was we wanted to make a statement and say that women are grossly underrepresented in the decision-making arena in every industry. So at the very least, what we could do is we could make a bold statement that perhaps Venice and Rome and Cannes have not been willing to make. Again, a tribute to the Torino Film Festival's innovative spirit and the fact that we have historically supported new and emerging voices. So we want to be, on the cutting edge. We want to be the first to do things, not the last. Mm-hmm. And in that spirit, we picked this jury so that we could show the world, boys and girls, future leaders, what female leadership looks like.
The masterclass is going to happen. The first one of the masterclasses is called Women in Film. And it's actually about this, about the misrepresentation or the poor representation of women in the film industry. This is an issue that is going on since many years. It's not just a new stuff, something that is was always there. It was always an issue that wasn't considered that much because, as you just said, being like men on top of the food chain, as we can say, it was very difficult to overcome this. But in this case, how did you try to treat this issue in a more provocative way inside of the masterclass? Because the masterclass would be run by you. There would be all the members of the jury would be part of the masterclass. And the issue is to try to find a way to destroy this kind of mechanism that keeps women on the side, is it?
There, you know, there's so many dimensions to this issue of women in cinema. So that's really what we've called the masterclass. And although we wanted to have all the jury members, because the issues that we're discussing are so substantive, to have an hour with five people is quite difficult. So we actually have asked two of the jury members who have a particularly interesting role that is beyond just film. So, you know, this issue of the underrepresentation of women in cinema has many dimensions. You know, Gina Davis, the famous American actress who was in Thelma and Louise, has done a lot of work in analyzing and exposing the data regarding the fact that women are not only not present in fair numbers in cinema. When they have a speaking role, they're speaking less, and they're less often the protagonist. So we know that data about how when you look at the largest films, the films with the largest budgets, you know, women are tend not to be leading, and they tend not to be present 50-50. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is women behind the camera, so the decision maker, the producer, the director. What happens when, like in every industry, women have more difficulty being funded because historically we consider, you know, the man the more responsible, experienced decision maker. Whether it's in venture capital or in the film industry, women have difficulty getting their ideas funded. So that speaks to why, you know, over 70 years of film awards in the United States, the Golden Globe and Oscars have only awarded two women in over 70 years. So Catherine Bigelow was recognized as the best director by the Oscars, and Barbara Streisand received the best director prize for Yentl. You know, because I don't come from a gender equality and feminist background, I've only learned all of these things in this last year, and it was shocking to me that we really take for granted the fact that how is it possible that women are half the world, and as my mother, who is a gynecologist, reminds me, we make the other half.
Exactly.
And yet in 70 years, the Oscars has only awarded one woman best director. I mean, that tells you how the system of having women unfairly represented in media, in the real world, not able to get financing, not able to have their voices honored and represented. It's kind of this chain of horribles.
Yeah.
And the end result is, how is it that in 70 years there's only one woman director who's been given the best director prize? I mean, it's outrageous, in
and
fact.
And she was not even considered like worth of that, because it was a big issue around Catherine Bigelow Oscars, because she was not bankable enough. She didn't make a big enough box office with her film, and she was not considered, which was another issue that I wanted to talk with you. The women sometimes are not considered able to be telling and to bring up stories that are not women's stories.
Well, this is actually something very interesting. You know, I think the importance of diversity and having these kinds of exchanges is that we all have something to learn, even about things that we think we know. So for me as a woman, you know, I'm 50, I've been around the world, I think I know what it means to be a woman. And yet I'll tell you something that I learned this year. When Greta Gerwig, who made the movie Little Women, was doing interviews, if you notice, she was typically with other, you know, the big wig directors, and they were all male. She was really the only woman at that level this year being engaged with for her film. And the point that she made that I had actually myself forgotten is that in school we read books that are considered the universal story. So, for example, the stories of Mark Twain and the stories of, the typical boy going on his, you know, a journey of adulthood. And we are given those stories as representing the universal experience. So we think that somehow boys and girls can relate to that story. But we don't give 14-year-old boys books to read about female stories and the female protagonist. So I think across the board, there's so much data and evidence that we think that, like, the man is the default human and women are like the second position human. What I heard, again, because of the importance of these discussions and debates, is that what happens is that young boys are not given the same exposure that young girls have to the other side. So whether it's homosexuality or dealing with refugee issues or dealing with people with handicaps, when you're dealing with something other than yourself and something other than your own situation, if you don't have exposure, it's really hard to be sympathetic and compassionate. Yeah. So girls are reading stories of boys and experiencing that as the universal story, but boys are not experiencing the stories of girls as the universal experience. You know, another interesting example is, for example, regarding female menstruation. You know, because my mother was a doctor, my father was also a doctor, as a child, you know, we'd be at the breakfast table and my mother would be on the phone giving medical advice to one of her patients, and the science of medicine and the science of treating women was very mainstream because, you know, it was a medical conversation. But we know in society today, you know, there, in so many cultures, a woman's menstruation is considered something that's dirty. And in the last years, there was a very important Indian filmmaker who's made a film about menstruation. It's only in the last 2-3 years that female orgasm, female menstruation, you know, the reality of everybody's mother, by the way, goes through these things. And yet, as a society, we silence and we ignore the experience of you know, of women. And this is, again, it's all sort of part of this disregard and lack of giving equal voice and equal value to women.
Which reflects a lot on cinema on film production, because we had last year at the Venice Festival, Fred, at a round table on this subject, on gender equality in cinema. And we were talking with this producer from US, and she was saying that the problem was not, it's true that the problem is that film festivals should select more film from women, but the problem is much behind this, is on the production chain, because if there are no studios or producers that are willing to produce film directed by women, there would never be enough films directed by women to be selected to festivals. So it's this kind of mentality that has to be broken, has to be canceled in terms of not only producing what can be, what is bankable, what is easily marketable, but something that can be interesting as a, as an issue, as a content. And I think that in this festival this year, we can touch with our hands that this is possible, you know, but probably because there were so more enlightened production companies in the back that was, willing to produce those kind of movies. So how can you think it's possible to invert this kind of habit of not producing women's film, because they're not, could not be good enough, because this is basically what it is, you know?
You know, the problem is actually even worse than you describe it. It's not just a matter of having a woman tell the story. We know that because we're social beings, we're all conditioned to want to fit in. So, you know, you and I are sitting here now in the Mole Antonelliana, and there's this video right now of Bugs Bunny. And you see in the images behind us, you know, the female depiction in this Bugs Bunny video is a girl with short shorts. And there's Betty Boo. She comes from the earliest cartoons. Again, you know, she's sexualized. And so the sad thing is that it's not really about, you know, men versus women. It's that women and men, they're, you know, there's almost like there are two kinds of women and men. There are the men and women who believe in fair representation of the genders. And I'll give you the example of Bong Joon-ho. Bong Joon-ho is the Korean filmmaker whose extraordinary film Parasite won an Oscar. Thanks to the fact that that film won, we all have paid more attention to his films. He happened to have also been at the Torino Film Festival many years ago. And this is why it's important to have jurors that are sympathetic to diverse stories. Because had he not won, had, you know, another Hollywood film made by a white man about a white story won, it would be perpetuating this narrative. But the fact that a non-English speaker Korean told a film about economic inequality and social injustice, and that film won, is a huge testament to the importance of festivals, the importance of awards, to the importance of letting global audiences at some level vote with what resonates with them. So like everybody else, I took a second look at Bong Joon-ho because he won the award, and I discovered his film Okja. I have to say, have you seen this film?
Yeah.
So I have to say that I salute Bong Joon-ho, because here is a man who comes from a culture that is, you know, very macho. And yet the film Okja is the film that we need to be seeing, because in that film, the heroine and the villain are both females. Tilda Swinton plays the fantastic villain, and the heroine is an adolescent girl. She's a little bit, let's call it, overweight, and she's wearing ordinary clothes, as children should be wearing. She's not wearing anything tight and short. She's not sexualized. She's not going to be a model when she grows up. She's like what you and I looked like when we were kids.
Yes.
Just an ordinary kid. And this ordinary kid, God bless her, is smart. She understands the value of money. She's resilient. She's courageous. She's fearless. And Hollywood and Disney and Pixar, they're not making those kinds of movies where you are celebrating an ordinary girl in a gender-neutral manner. That's what young girls need to be seeing. So I want to be very clear that I don't think the solution is just having women make movies. It's rather, let's recognize that, like with everything else, like with the environment, like with social injustice, like with the global pandemic, we all rise and fall together. So gender inequality, unfair laws that discriminate against women, unequal pay for the same work, sexual violence, all of these, you know, the encroachment on women's reproductive rights, this is everybody's problem. It's a man's problem as much as it is a woman's problem, and the solution is going to come from men and women together.
So the
point of the festival and the point of this conversation is to say we salute people like Bong Joon-ho who make a movie that is about humanity. It's about people. It offers a role model for girls that much of mainstream television and film doesn't offer. I'd like to call out in a negative way, I have to say, the Netflix series Suits. I happen to be an attorney, and I only watched it because, of course, Meghan Markle got all this attention, and she's apparently, she plays a paralegal. I have to say I found it very offensive because, no attorney shows up at the office at 9 o'clock in the morning in a cocktail dress, 4-inch heels with like all of her body parts showing. Now, the male depiction is actually pretty accurate. That's the way male lawyers and male staff, show up at work. So we're already disrespecting and ignoring the truth. I show up to work looking like I'm looking right now here with you. And any hardworking lawyer who works 18 hours a day, I trust me when I say, they're not fully made up. They're not wearing 4-inch heels. So that means that we're ignoring women as they are, and we're presenting this kind of fantasy woman that doesn't represent anybody.
The only thing in that series is that at the least all women are very sexualized, as you say, like aesthetically speaking, but they're very strong women. Each one of them. They have a strong, they are not victim, barely.
But this was a kind of
concession that they have to do in order to be more sellable.
No, but that's ridiculous. This sexualization of the female is saying that, when you say someone is sexy, you are showcasing your sexuality. And in a professional environment like you sitting here with me today, it is a professional environment. Our sexuality has no bearing. A heterosexual, homosexual, whatever sexuality. And to say that women are only valued and their presence is only welcomed if they're in a sexualized posture is succumbing to a certain male fantasy. And I have to say that, in the time that I've been here in Torino, We'll talk more about the larger gender equality campaign that is being launched again, you know, thanks to the opportunity at the festival. It's called the Lady Boss Campaign. I've interviewed young girls all over the world, including in Torino. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that I'm sorry to learn that in America, in Europe, where we think of ourselves as more advanced than other places, girls from as early as 10, 15, 17 are saying, and we have the footage that we've shared on the Lady Boss campaign Instagram and Facebook pages, they're saying that they feel that society doesn't value them equal to boys. I mean, to have a 15-year-old girl in Torino tell me that she thinks society doesn't value her as a person, and that when her best friend, who's also apparently very pretty and smart, speaks to boys, she dumbs herself down. That is because the depiction in very influential media and entertainment says that a girl is valued if she's hot and sexy. Whereas, you know, when you just shower and show up clean and well-groomed like you have or I have, somehow society is telling girls, that's not enough. Mm-hmm. And then the second part of it is that, again, this is a kind of crazy serendipity. When I was in Rome a few weeks ago for the Rome Film Festival, I met a wonderful Italian filmmaker. He's in his early 40s, and we were just chatting in line, which is the fun thing that happens when you go to a festival. You make new friends. And, of course, I told him about what I'm doing here, and I told him about my gender equality campaign. And when I'm talking to a man, I quickly ask them, you know, do you have a girlfriend? Do you have a wife? Do you have a daughter? Because I'm looking to see if they have a daughter or a wife. They're already a little bit, you know, more sympathetic because they have a female in their household, yeah, you know, that is bringing these issues to the table. And he tells me that, yes, he is married. And he told me that his wife, an Italian woman in her 30s from Rome, is in the hospital right now as we speak. She's been in the hospital over a month because she's anorexic. And she shares a hospital room with a 13-year-old girl, again, in Rome, who's anorexic also. Why? Because they are trying to be as skinny as the images that Disney and Hollywood portray. Now, I was invited to participate in the View Conference, which yeah. is based in Torino a few weeks ago. As you know, it's the leading industrial industry event for animation, for gaming, for digital media, which now, you know, it has such a huge influence on the world. And again, for the first time, in preparation for my presentation, I went back and I looked at some cartoon images. You know, in my day life, I don't normally see cartoons. And there are the recent cartoons from Disney called The Incredibles and Frozen. And what I noticed to my own, you know, shock is that the waist of the girl in The Incredibles is the waist circumference, is the circumference of her neck. Mm-hmm. Okay, and in Frozen, the princess heroine, by the way, whose image you also see in shoe stores in Rome and Turin, because Disney is using those images that they sell to companies that are selling shoes and other products to children. Similarly, she has a waist and a physique that doesn't look like me, doesn't look like your mother.
Doesn't look like any other human. Right?
However, the guy in Frozen is a little bit overweight. He's not good looking. Okay, mm-hmm. He looks like the guy next door, which says that you could be the guy next door and be the leading character in a Disney film, but if you are not, you know, impossibly perfect looking with gargantuan eyes and pouty lips and a waist that, you know, the circumference of your neck, you're not good enough for Disney. You're not good enough to be, you know, part of the, you know, the universal fantasy that then goes on, to spread those sexist, unhealthy images all over the world. And then there are the girls who look at those images that are showing up everywhere, including the new Wonder Woman, by the way.
Yeah.
The new Wonder Woman, again, you know, here we are, 2020, and Wonder Woman is wearing a strapless metallic bathing suit. I find that offensive. And then in Italy and elsewhere, but I've seen it in Italy, there are makeup companies that are using the Wonder Woman image. So that means that, you know, during the pandemic, you can't buy regular clothes, but you can buy makeup. Somehow makeup made the cut for essential. So yeah. We have women in Torino and every other city where there is a lockdown, being told by society that you're free to go into a store and buy cosmetics made with chemicals that adversely affect your endocrine system, which leads to cancer, but you're not free to, I don't know, you know, buy a book or do other kinds of activities, other kinds of commercial activities. So then, you know, as we know from the very insightful documentary called Social Dilemma on Netflix, mm-hmm. social media amplifies these kinds of negative images of women, and we know, thanks to research done by many people, but including Jonathan Haidt from NYU and New York University in New York, who is cited in that film, that in the last 10 years, girls from the age of 10 to 14, they're hardly, you know, in puberty, right? 10 to yeah. 14, the self-harm and suicide rates of these girls has gone up over 150%. So 10 to 14-year-old girls, which means that they're being bombarded by these images from Disney, from Kim Kardashian, from Jennifer Lopez, from images. Again, it's kind of like a feedback loop of it's the celebrities that show up in entertainment and in marketing, and then, the data is very clear. Girls are not eating. They're having unhealthy diets. They're harming themselves because they have low self-esteem, because our society is bombarding them from a very young age with images that are unhealthy and unachievable. So we all need to take responsibility for this sort of complex problem that has many inputs. So media, cinema, advertising, marketing, fashion, not only creates the problems that we've also talked about, but as I'll talk this evening with Homera Sellier, who will be on our first master class. Homera Sellier is the founder of Innocence in Danger.
Exactly.
Which is an organization that she founded 20 years ago to protect children from sexual abuse. She's one of the people who brought the first case to fight Jeffrey Epstein in France. So again, the ugly chain of horribles is that a society that says that a 14-year-old girl should walk out into the street with short shorts, her abdomen exposed, her breasts spilling out of her clothing, creates a dangerous environment for sexual predation. So a Jeffrey Epstein who walks down the street and he sees young girls who are in these highly sexualized postures. When you're dressed sexy, you're messaging. You know, when I sit home alone and I work in my Uniqlo outfit, you know, I'm not messaging. When I come here to be with you, I deliberately chose an outfit that is professional because our dress and our uniform is a message.
Absolutely.
You know, didn't show up in your pajamas, nor did I. So the fact that girls walk in the street, girls and women, in a sexy outfit, you know, a lot of women say that they're free to wear whatever they want and they do it to feel good. I don't agree. I think that we've been so, so conditioned that our value is in our beauty and our value is in being sexy. From the Disney movies to the suits to the way we see women depicted in media, that we all only feel good if we look like we're some kind of porn star.
Yeah, borderline porn star. Yes.
And by the way, I wouldn't even say borderline, you know, because in the I was born in 1970, and in the early 70s and 80s, there were laws in the United States. I don't know what they were exactly called, but it was kind of like, community decency laws. Mm-hmm. So pornographic magazines, when they were on the newsstand, they had to be wrapped in black so that a child or someone underage was not exposed to those, you know, offensive images. Now, when you look at the attire of Jennifer Lopez, Beyonce, you look at these, music videos, a man doesn't need to go to a porno site. Pornography in dress and media in music videos is so mainstream. Okay, now you and I, as middle-aged adults, we forget that we grew up at a time where that kind of content, which is fine for consenting adults, you know, at an appropriate time and place, was not part of the mainstream. But today, if you're a 14-year-old girl or boy, you walk down the street and you see the equivalent of pornography every single day, all day long.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. This is a very interesting issue that we should keep on the side for our next talks. And so we are closing our first talk, but there is this Women in Film Masterclass tonight. Today is the 21st. For those who are going to listen to this podcast after the 21st, you can go on the Torino Film Festival website and check the content of the masterclass that's going to happen.
It's going to be on our YouTube channel.
And
so
on the
everyone
YouTube
needs
channel.
To go to
yes,
YouTube
you're right.
and go to the Torino Film Festival. And, you know, although the masterclass was conceived of as something for students, and we have students from Polytech University and University of Torino, we've created an email. It's tff.masterclass@gmail.com. So if any of your listeners would like to ask a question during the masterclass, if they email tff.masterclass@gmail.com, my colleague who will be with me at the masterclass will read those emails. So it gives the general public an opportunity to participate in any language that they'd like, by the way. So it could be in Italian, Japanese, English, whatever
French,
language.
German, whatever.
Yes.
Okay, so thanks a lot, Fedra Fateh, for having been with me today. And this is the first one of a long series of meetings. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I look forward to talk to you again tomorrow.
Thank you.
I'm Angela Cerbi for Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.